It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Boisson. Coming up, we learn about the long history of Mexicans and Mexican-Americans in Wisconsin. First, Governor Walker delivered his 8th State of the State address earlier this afternoon, highlighting the Foxconn deal and other business developments, unveiling a new child tax credit that would give Wisconsin families $100 per child annually, and also calling for changes in the state's welfare system. Sean Johnson, WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief, joins us now to continue our look at the governor's priorities for Wisconsin. Sean, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So, Sean, you've been covering the state of the state for many years now. How would you compare this speech to past ones?
I think this simple observation that was pretty apparent about a quarter of the way through the speech is this is pretty long for Governor Walker, who has typically kept these things short, especially compared to, say, Governor Jim Doyle before him, who would use this speech, as Governor Walker did today, to roll through all of his accomplishments and lay out a lengthy agenda for the legislature. You haven't heard Governor Walker do that in previous speeches, even budget addresses. You know, this is by far the longest speech he's given, and it really fit that mold of, you know, previous governors who want to go through a laundry list of stuff they've done and stuff they'd like to yet accomplish.
Well, and it's no surprise, I think, this is an election year, and I'm guessing that that plays into that.
I'm sure, in terms of the content of the speech, he's been through elections before. I mean, just thinking back to the 2012 recall, he had one of these speeches, and his 2014 address was under similar circumstances. So, yes, this is an election year speech and an election year agenda. He, as you know, Walker often likes to make sure that you don't miss the big point that he is trying to drive home, and so he'll repeat it. Mm-hmm. And one of those points that he drove home this time was that they're getting things done. And so this is very similar to what he said after Senate Democrats picked up a seat in that special election recently. Why did Democrats win this Republican seat? Are you as Republicans worried? And Governor Walker said at the time, people in Wisconsin need to know that they might see Washington Republicans not getting things done, but we are. And so it's not surprising to hear the governor deliver that message in this speech. He definitely did it several times, in case you missed it.
And what was the reaction from the body, both Republicans and Democrats, during the address?
Well, anytime you have one of these speeches, it's pretty predictable that one side of the aisle is going to be standing up and applauding for a lot of what they hear a governor say. And, you know, in this case, Republicans have a big majority in the legislature in both the Assembly and the Senate, and so they were on their feet quite a bit for the governor's speech. Democrats, not so much. You know, there were some Democratic bills in this speech, and those got applause. You know,
and he actually singled out a Democrat for praise on work on, I believe it was the rural issues, maybe?
Well, the one that's, I think, that sticks out in my mind anyway is Evan Goyke,
right,
for his work on the bill that would close down Lincoln Hills, the Juvenile Correction Center, and set up 5 new institutions for juveniles around the state. He called out Evan Goyke there, and Evan Goyke got applause from both sides of the aisle, kind of a rare moment there. You also saw some applause from Democrats when he talked about, when the governor talked about making senior care, the senior care prescription drug program, permanent. That's something that they have, you know, pushed for, mm-hmm, for years. So
there might be some points in the priorities that could get bipartisan support.
Oh, I mean, like something like senior care has always been, there's definite overlap there between Republicans and Democrats. I think they would probably like to own that issue because they've been the more, you know, full throated defenders of senior care over the years, or have tried to be. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if that were to come up for a vote, you'd be, I think, hard pressed to see Democrats voting against it, unless the devil were in the details. Mm-hmm. Some of his other health care stuff, not so much, because, you know, there's pros and cons to those.
And let's actually dig into that. Governor Walker unveiled his health care stability plan. This is what he had to say.
Our citizens are crying out for a stable health care system. And you know what? Washington has failed to act, so it is time for us to lead in Wisconsin. That is why today I propose the creation of a health care stability plan. Most people receive their health care coverage from their employer. and premium increases for the majority of employer-based plans were fairly modest this past year at about 5%. The biggest concern I hear about as I travel the state is from those who are worried about pre-existing conditions. With this in mind, I propose that we enact a law in Wisconsin that will guarantee coverage of pre-existing conditions.
So healthcare on the national level certainly has been a very contentious issue. The governor recently said he would boost the Affordable Care Act as it is applied in Wisconsin. So how does this healthcare stability plan play into this larger goal?
So the reinsurance plan that he's talking about there would be, I guess the idea is to make sure that insurance companies don't go away or that they don't charge insurance premiums that are completely unaffordable. So you're talking about an infusion of government cash to these insurance companies. Most of it would be federal money. There would be a portion of it that would be from the state. The governor says that would come from savings in the Medicaid program, although at this point we don't exactly know, you know, what those would be. But this is not something that would go directly to healthcare consumers. It would go to the insurance companies. They would potentially have the option of lowering premiums because they got that infusion of government cash, but we don't know that that would be a requirement for getting this. And we don't know that, you know, we don't know what the right price is to make sure that it works. You know, is $200 million enough? We're not sure. And this is a, I mean, this is an idea that's relatively new in terms of its rollout. So we're still learning the details and the cost on that.
WPR's Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson with us recapping the state address that was given just a couple hours ago. And Sean, another part of the address that seemed to be kind of a late addition to the issues that have been floating around is this $100 million tax credit that will go to families with children, $100 per child.
Yeah, that's And to describe it on stage, the governor brought a number of kids and presumably parents up there, too. But there were kids up there on stage as he said, look, this is real money. It could buy a pair of shoes. You know, it could help out in a number of ways.
And where's that money coming from?
Well, he's saying it's from a surplus in the state budget because, I mean, the state does have a balance in its general fund now because tax revenues are better than were projected when, you know, when they pass the budget. So it's not a huge balance by any means, but there is money in the state's general fund. And the governor has said in the past that when they have that, he wants to return it to the taxpayers. The thing with doing that immediately is this is all based off of projections. And I mean, a few years ago, there were projections that there was a lot of money in the general fund and they turned out to be wrong. And so the state spent that money used it for tax cuts, and then it had to go back and have budget cuts to make up the difference when that money didn't come through. So this is a very brand, you know, this is hot off the presses here, this $100 per kid tax credit. And, you know, we need to learn the details on that. But anytime you're talking about a tax credit based on projected surplus, you're going to run into those issues. And it's not something that's going to go away either, presumably. Future governors, future legislatures, future budgets would have that lost revenue to deal with.
As you said, the governor's kind of repeated chorus was, we are getting positive things done for the people of Wisconsin. Assembly Minority Leader Gordon Hintz provided the Democratic response, and he had a little different take on things.
Yeah. One thing that Gordon Hintz has been pretty consistent about as Assembly Democratic Minority Leader is that that he wants to talk about Foxconn and does it whenever he's given the chance, really. I mean, that has become kind of a galvanizing message for Democrats. It is one of the governor's big accomplishments in office. I mean, it's hard to think of a more consequential bill that he signed in this term anyway than the Foxconn bill. But it's something Democrats want to talk about because they can frame it as the state spending $3 billion cash for this foreign corporation that it could have been using for other things here in Wisconsin.
And I think recently, actually, some estimates were saying it's closer to $4.5 billion.
Yeah. So if you total up all the local money and, you know, the entirety of the Foxconn package, money for expanding a highway that the state might not have otherwise done, then you get up to $4.5 billion. But in terms of a cash payment to Foxconn, that's more like $3 billion from state government, not a tax cut, but like actually a cash payment. So the governor did talk about that in his speech as well. It was about 35 minutes in. So there was some question, will the governor bring this up or not? Because he knows the political pros and cons here. It's not something he brought up in the very beginning. He didn't mention it. But he didn't make it like the crown jewel of his State of the State speech in an election year.
Anything else that Gordon Hintz touched on that we should make note of?
I think it seems like it was about providing that contrast. And the other thing that sticks out is he talked about transportation. I mean, Democrats want to talk about transportation and the fact that Republicans weren't able to agree to a transportation budget that would fix the state's transportation woes. You know, road conditions are a tangible, piece of evidence of whether state government is fixing problems or not. And so that's something you can expect to hear Democrats talk about quite a bit.
Sean, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us to recap the governor's goals for the coming year. You can tune in tomorrow to both the morning show and to Central Time for more analysis and discussion about the State of the State address, and we'll ask what you think as well. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You may think of the Mexican presence in Wisconsin as a recent development, but people from Mexico and Mexican Americans from border states have been enriching our state's culture and history for over a century.
In a new book from the Wisconsin Historical Society, Sergio Gonzalez traces the stories of the individuals and groups that have been part of the Mexican experience in Wisconsin. He's a doctoral candidate in the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of History with research interests in American labor, immigration, and working class history, as well as the state's Latino community. Sergio, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You talk about the first Mexican resident of the state, Rafael Baez, who was an accomplished musician who came in the late 19th century and had quite a career in Milwaukee. But the first significant group of Mexicans came in the early 20th century. What brought them here?
They came looking for work. They came looking for new employment opportunities. In the late 1910s and early 1920s, there weren't as many opportunities in Mexico. With changes in immigration policy, federal immigration policy here in the United States, industrialists and agriculturalists in Wisconsin looked south for new labor force to bring to Wisconsin. Unfortunately for this labor force, they didn't know when they were recruited to come to Wisconsin that many of them were coming as strikebreakers. Mm-hmm. They were brought up to basically help break some of the larger unions in Milwaukee. And so the very initial experience upon arrival here in Wisconsin in the city of Milwaukee was that of individuals who were coming to take jobs, individuals who were coming to take away opportunities from Milwaukeeans.
Were there other areas of the state where they settled maybe for agricultural opportunities?
Absolutely. So the first large groups that come to Milwaukee are actually following in line with other migrant laborers that had been coming to Wisconsin throughout the 1910s. And many of them had been recruited to work in the beet industry. In Spanish, they're called betabeleros, which is beet pickers. And they were following the paths of Eastern and Russian Europeans who had come before them. As those immigrant groups started to settle out of the migrant streams, Mexican descent individuals would replace them. And throughout the 1910s and 1920s, sometimes there were solteros, there were solos, but sometimes there were families as well, because usually migrant work was a family industry where everyone had to contribute to help provide for the family.
The agricultural season isn't through the winter here. So were they going back either to southern states or to Mexico itself?
Right. So in the 1910s and 1920s, they would absolutely follow the migrant stream. And so they would come up during the planting season. They would travel to a different farm for another planting season because, of course, agriculture moves in different steps throughout the year. And then they would travel back for the harvest season. But at the end of the harvest season in fall, most of them would go back either to the southern parts of the United States or to find other agricultural work where the weather was more temperate.
So what was the next wave after that initial wave in the 1910s and 1920s? When did we next see a large influx of Mexican workers and residents?
So the Great Depression decimates the state's Mexican descent community. In Milwaukee, by 1929, there were nearly 7,000 Mexican descent individuals, families living in Milwaukee, had settled themselves, had begun to incorporate themselves into the city in some way. But the Great Depression completely decimates that community. From 7,000, by 1935, it's closer to 1,500.
Wow.
Some of them leave voluntarily, repatriate themselves to go back to Mexico to look for opportunities. But others are forced to leave. They're deported by local institutions who are looking to relieve the welfare rolls throughout the 1930s. And Mexicans are seen as both surplus labor, but they're also portrayed by the local media and by institutions as being saps on those welfare institutions. And so the community is estimated. And again, it's not until World War II that we see a regrowth of the community. And the pull, again, is labor.
Often immigrants settle where their fellow countrymen and women are. Was that also the case for Mexicans?
It is. Their decision to settle was very much determined by where their employment was. And so the initial groups that came to Milwaukee settled on the near south side, around the tanneries, the foundries, the factories that they were working at. Their neighbors were often the European groups that they were replacing at times in the factories, or they were working side by side. To this day, the near south side of Milwaukee continues to be the predominant Latino part of town, and it's pretty impressive that over 100 years, the heart of that community continues to be in that initial place of settlement.
Sergio Gonzalez is a doctoral candidate in the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of History. He's the author of a new book titled Mexicans in Wisconsin. And as you just said, Sergio, the Mexican residents were living alongside the earlier waves of immigrants, often from Europe. Religion seems like it was a real bridge between those new Mexican residents and the communities that they were moving into. Can you give us some examples of that?
It's unfortunate that in many of the other social spaces, educational spaces, Mexicans found themselves discriminated against. But within the church, they found a sort of sense of shared fellowship. It was an understanding of a shared Catholicism, a shared religiosity that brought people together. So the most important story begins at the Holy Trinity Church, which is actually one of the oldest Catholic churches in Milwaukee. Mexican immigrants begin arriving at the church in the 1920s, and the white Catholics at the church look at them and say, these are individuals who can't understand our Mass, but they're Catholic like us, and they're here to praise the Lord. And so the decision was made within the white community to begin outreach efforts to the Mexican community. And working together, they developed their own independent Mexican mission chapel, which is now Our Lady of Guadalupe Holy Trinity Church. And throughout the 20th century, the church has continued to be a place where not all bridges have been built, but at a minimum, it's a space for imaginations to be kind of recreated, for different possibilities to be imagined.
You did say, and this has certainly been the case with other immigrants who are the latest arrivals, that there is friction, often with the established communities that are from different ethnic backgrounds. And like other immigrant groups, Mexicans set up their own community centers and also mutual aid groups. What was the purpose, especially of those mutual aid groups?
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because the mutual aid societies in many ways mimic those that their predecessors had created. The two famous ones in Milwaukee in the late 1920s, La Sociedad Mutualista Hispano-Azteca and La Sociedad Emilio Carranza, organizations that celebrate ethnic pride. They celebrate a cultural heritage that is not represented in other spaces in Milwaukee. In other spaces in Milwaukee, Mexicans are told that they need to speak English to integrate into the community. They're told that they have to adopt American customs to be truly accepted. But even when they do those things, Mexicans find themselves still outside the boundaries of acceptance in Milwaukee. And so they make the decision to create these institutions as a way to celebrate their heritage, but also as a place to pull back and to build community within themselves. And so they do everything from celebrating fiestas to celebrating religious traditions to setting up banking institutions. Everything that you could think of, they try to do on their own because they can't find the ways to do it in other places.
One difference that stood out to me is that early arrivals were Mexican nationals, but later waves were actually made up by a lot of U.S. citizens of Mexican descent who had probably been living in some of the border states. Were those groups treated differently? Did the existing communities in Wisconsin think of Mexican nationals versus U.S. nationals who were Mexican differently?
In some ways, yes. So the shift really occurs in 1947 when the state's agricultural industry looks towards Texas as its base for recruiting labor. And beginning in 1947, for the next decade, more than 10,000 Tejanos, or Texas Mexicans, make their way to Wisconsin every single year to work in agricultural fields. But unfortunately, they find many of the same barriers that Mexican nationals had faced before them. They faced segregation and discrimination in places as far-fetched as Door County and Waupun, just as Mexican nationals had faced in Milwaukee in the 1920s. Their calls for a sense of citizenship, in other words, that their legitimacy was based on their American citizenship in the country, sometimes was not actually met with reality. And so they faced many of the same barriers. And by the 1960s and 70s, we really do see a cross-national, cross-documentation movement building in places like, like Milwaukee, where these communities say, regardless of our documentation status or our residency status, we're facing many of the same issues.
As we start to wrap up, I do want to move forward to the last few decades and touch on Chicano activism. First, Sergio, can you tell us what Chicano means?
It's a political identity. It's a cultural identity. In the 1960s and early 1970s, young Mexican-Americans or people of Mexican descent began to try to reclaim a sense of who what their cultural heritage was. And it was often in defiance of a normative culture that meant to assimilate them into a larger society. And what they claimed is that their linguistic heritage, their cultural heritage, their historical background was important and needed to be not only preserved but celebrated. And so the identity of Chicano is a cultural and a national identity that grew in the 1960s.
You touched on some of the early topics that were of interest to Chicano activists. What are some of the issues now that have continued through over decades?
Fundamentally, the questions that confront people of Latin American descent and specifically Mexican descent in our state are the same ones that people in the 1920s faced, which is, how do I create a sense of belonging in this space? How do I find a sense of community in a space that has often recruited me to come here for work, that needs my labor, that needs my population growth, and yet denies me the space in my communities? And so we see a series of anti-immigrant laws, both at the state house and at the federal level. And if we look back in history in the 1920s and the 1950s and the 1970s, people of Mexican descent faced similar issues. And their claims were the same. I have come here to build a life for myself. You have told me that I'm a part of your community, and I desire to be a full member of that.
Sergio, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Sergio Gonzalez. He's a doctoral candidate in the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of History and is the author of a new book from the Wisconsin Historical Society Press titled Mexicans in Wisconsin. Now, a long night's sleep can seem like a luxury, but it turns out that the time we spend asleep is as important to our bodies as eating well and exercising. And it's not your imagination if you think how, when, and how long you sleep has changed over the years. Matthew Walker is a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and is the director of its Center for Human Sleep Science. He's a former professor of psychiatry at Harvard University, and his most recent book is Why We Sleep: Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. Matthew, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's set the stage. What actually happens when we sleep?
Well, we used to think that sleep was largely a passive state where the body simply rested and the mind was dormant. And now we know nothing further from the truth could be actually happening here. The brain is incredibly and intensely active. In fact, during some stages of sleep, your brain is up to 30% more active than when you're awake. And that's critical for aspects of learning, memory, creativity. It also helps with emotional therapy. It provides a form of essentially emotional first aid. Downstairs in the body, we know that deep sleep actually offers one of the greatest forms of blood pressure medication that you could ever wish for. It also seems to recharge your immune system and refresh that immune system. It also overhauls aspects of our metabolism, things like our ability to regulate glucose to keep us away from a path of diabetes. And sleep also regulates our appetite hormones so that we don't overeat the next day, so that we feel satisfied with our food and that we're making the right choices in terms of what we eat.
I thought it was really interesting and really great the way you explained it, because I actually understood it, that our brain is actually, like every night, our brain is getting rid of stuff it doesn't need and building and strengthening things it does. So how does the brain do to what seem like very different and almost opposing activities?
It's fascinating, isn't it? So we've we've realized over the past 10 or 15 years that sleep after learning is essential to hit the save button on new memories so that you don't forget. So sleep in that way is really future-proofing the information within the brain. But we've recently learned that sleep is much more intelligent than we once gave it credit for. Sleep can actually identify things that perhaps you've already learned previously and you don't need to create duplicate copies of. It's a little bit like sorting through a hard drive and weeding out the stuff that you don't need. And also sleep tries to prioritize information, so things that are perhaps especially salient and important to you, sleep will preferentially enhance those things. And those things that perhaps don't seem to be as emotionally necessary for you, sleep may even let go of. So sleep is clever in that way. It seems to have an elegant algorithm for informational storage. And it has to have that, by the way, because the brain doesn't have infinite storage capacity. It's a fixed storage system. So something has to stay, something has to go, and sleep seems to have a really quite clever equation for dictating what you remember and what you forget.
And so what happens if we don't give our brains a chance to do all that by getting good and consistent night's sleep? What happens to those important functions?
Well, certainly there are incredible deleterious health and disease consequences downstairs in the body, but upstairs in the brain, we know that if you're not getting enough sleep, firstly, your brain cannot commit new experiences to memory effectively. In other words, your brain can't learn efficiently. So it's almost as though the memory circuits of the brain become waterlogged and you can't absorb new information. We also know that there are certain parts of your brain, particularly the higher level rational regions of the brain, regions that we call the prefrontal cortex that sit just above your eyes. Those areas act like a very clever CEO of the brain. But when you're underslept, those regions seem to get taken offline, so you become much more impulsive, much more emotionally irrational. You become much more hot-headed. You're much more likely to snap in terms of your emotions. We also know that if you're not getting enough sleep, the brain is actually not detoxing itself of the metabolic byproducts that build up whilst we're awake during the day. Wakefulness essentially is a form of low-level brain damage, but one of the critical toxins that sleep washes away at night is a sticky protein called beta amyloid. And it is beta amyloid that seems to be one of the leading causes of Alzheimer's disease. And this is why we now have developed and found very strong, significant links between people who aren't getting enough sleep during their lifespan and marked increases in Alzheimer's risk later in life.
We're talking with Matthew Walker, a professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Berkeley, about his most recent book, Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. And Matthew, let's look across the life cycle and how our sleep needs change. And let's start with before birth. What does sleep have to do with fetal development?
It seems to have to do everything with fetal development, because in fact, almost 90% of the time that you are in utero developing, you are actually in some form of sleep. And it seems to be a particular type of sleep. It's a stage of sleep that we call rapid eye movement sleep, something that often is associated with dreaming. And it's that stage of sleep during that early developmental time in life that is actually acting almost like an electrical fertilizer for the central nervous system, particularly for the brain. So REM sleep at that time of life, it's a little bit like an internet service provider that has a whole new neighborhood of houses. And its job is to go in there and lay down all of that fiber optic cable for high-speed broadband connectivity. And it seems to sort of flourish and populate all of the different neighborhoods of the brain with this connectivity, and then actually ignite it with that high-speed broadband electrical connection activity. So sleep in utero is absolutely absolutely essential. And there were studies done back in the 1970s where they actually deprived young infant rats of that REM sleep, and it significantly blunted the developmental trajectory of brain structure. So I think it's a real warning for us as we see sleep time start to decrease across the lifespan, but particularly in younger adults.
So does that continue once a child is born in the first year of life, the first few years of life? Is sleep that important for development then as well?
It is. It is absolutely essential. And not just in humans, by the way. In every species that we've studied to date, sleep is in highest amounts early in life. It seems to be a universal feature of sleep and life on this planet. And we think it's exactly for that purpose. It's for the explosion of growth and development, both of the body, but also in particular those animals that have complex nervous systems. That's where we see sleep in highest amounts in those early stages of life, post-utero.
Well, let's move on to the age group that gets a lot of attention and grief about their sleep habits, teenagers. What is that shift that I think any of us who have been teenagers or have lived with teenagers have seen where they stay up late, they want to sleep as long as possible, and they have a really hard time getting up?
Yeah, what is going on there? Well, there's really a collision of two factors, one that's natural and one that's artificial. The natural part of that equation is that once you go through that adolescent transition, there is a shift that happens in your 24-hour clock timing within the brain. And it forces you further forward in time, so you start to want to go to bed later and wake up later. So it's not teenagers being rebellious. It's not their fault. If you say, you know, get to bed, it's 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and they're still awake, you know, at 11 o'clock. It's just their biology, and it's a genetic predeterminant. It's not their fault. However much they would wish or will themselves to be asleep, it's not going to happen. So that's the first aspect, and that's very natural. We know that that happens. The artificial force, however, that often makes us think that teenagers are perhaps a little bit lazy, especially during weekends where they seem to sleep in or sleep too much. You know, it's that idea of a parent going into the teenager's room, you pull the covers off and you open the curtains and you say, look, you're wasting the day, it's midday. Well, part of that is due to that fast-forwarding in time of their 24-hour clock. But a much bigger part of that is that they are sleeping off a remarkable debt, a sleep debt, that we have lumbered them with this incessant model of early school start times during the week. Mm-hmm. And that has to change because it has marked deleterious consequences, both on their academic development, their grades, as well as their psychiatric and mental states, as well as their life expectancy when it comes to driving accidents as well. So that's the second part of that adolescent equation.
And finally, what about the elderly? There's a common belief that the elderly don't need as much sleep. Is that actually true?
Well, it's one of the myths that I actually debunk in the book, and I spend an entire chapter on this, Sleep Across the Lifespan. It's not true. We know that older adults seem to need just as much sleep in the 60s, 70s, and 80s as they did in the 40s. It's simply that the older adult brain is not capable of generating the sleep that it still necessarily needs. So it's a deficit in the ability to get the sleep rather than a reduction in the need for sleep.
And we'll talk about some of the things that can interfere with getting a good night's sleep in just a moment. We're talking with sleep researcher Matthew Walker about his new book, Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you feel guilty about sleeping a full 8 hours or maybe for taking a nap? Has how and how much you sleep changed as you've aged? And are you one of the millions of Americans with sleep problems? Call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Matthew Walker. He's a professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Berkeley and the director of its Center for Human Sleep Science. His most recent book is Why We Sleep: Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. And we want to hear from you. How well do you sleep? Have you found any tricks to help you get a good night's sleep? Or maybe you need some. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Matthew, you lay out a really convincing case for why adequate sleep is important. But what if it eludes us? There are a lot of people that have sleep problems. What should people do and what should they not do?
Well, I think beyond making sure that you carve out enough time to sleep, and right now the World Health Organization recommends an 8-hour sleep opportunity every night, there are probably five things that people can do to start to get better sleep. The first is regularity. Try to go to bed at the same time and wake up at the same time, no matter what. Sometimes people will make the mistake of sort of staying up late and then waking up late, particularly on the weekends. It's what we call social jet lag. And that sort of pulling forward and back of your body clock in time is really not great for your sleep. So keep it regular. The second is temperature. Keep your bedroom cool, probably cooler than you think. Around about 67, 68 degrees is optimal for most people. The reason is that your body needs to drop its core temperature to initiate sleep and stay asleep soundly. So you can help it do that by keeping the room cool. The next is darkness. We actually are a dark-deprived society in this modern age. And you need darkness at night to allow the release of a hormone that is called melatonin. And melatonin helps time the healthy onset of natural sleep. So perhaps in the last hour before bed, just shut off half the lights. You don't need all of the lights on. Stay away from LED screens. They are particularly damaging, and that's been demonstrated with research that that can block that release of melatonin in deleterious ways. The next thing is not to stay in bed awake for too long. So if you've been in bed, either falling asleep or if you've woken up and you're trying to get back to sleep, if you've been awake there for about 25 minutes, don't stay in bed is the advice, because your brain quickly learns the association between your bed being the place of being awake rather than being asleep.
And probably being stressed about not being able to fall asleep.
Exactly, yeah. So you, and association is a powerful thing in that regard, just as you mentioned. So what you should really do is get up, go to a different room, and in dim light, maybe just read a book. Don't check emails. Don't try to eat. It creates a habit. And only return to bed when you're sleepy, and that way you will relearn the association between your bedroom being about the place of sleep. The final thing usually makes me deeply unpopular, which is that you should abstain from caffeine after about 2 p.m., and you should skip the nightcap. Now, when it comes to caffeine, everyone knows that caffeine is an alerting substance. It can keep you awake, keep you a little wired. What some people don't realize, however, is that even if you can have a cup of coffee at night and you can fall asleep and stay asleep, you won't get into the very deepest stages of sleep. It will be a lighter form of sleep that you get. So then you wake up the next day, you don't feel refreshed, and you find yourself reaching for two cups of coffee rather than one, and it becomes a dependency and addiction cycle. Alcohol, then, is perhaps the most misunderstood drug of all. Alcohol is a sedative, and sedation is not sleep. Mm. So what people mistake when they say, oh, I have a little drink, a little nightcap before bed, and it helps me fall asleep, all you're doing is actually knocking your brain out. You're not helping it get into natural sleep. And then there are two more problems with alcohol. Firstly, alcohol will fragment your sleep, so you will wake up many more times throughout the night. And then finally, alcohol is actually very effective at blocking one type of sleep called rapid eye movement sleep, dream sleep, that we spoke about before.
And I'm going to ask you to hold on there, Matthew, because we have several people who want to join the conversation. We're getting a little short on time. So let's go to the phones, and Kelly in Milwaukee is up first. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Oh, It's not really a question. It's just my experience, you should say. I was fine falling asleep, never had a problem until I had a child. And I call it, like, momsomnia. Like, any little thing you hear, like, you're up, you're ready to go. It takes you, like, 4 sleeping pills a night to be able to just, like, get into bed.
All right. And, Kelly, I want to give Matthew a chance to respond. Matthew, I know you write quite a bit about sleeping pills.
Yeah, I do. And this is not uncommon with young children. In fact, there's some studies where people have looked at how the brain, whilst it's asleep, responds to the name or the sound of that individual's child. And the brain seems to be on hyper alert even when you're asleep relative to other sounds. So it's a very real phenomenon. Sleeping pills are a concern. The book goes into detail. Those sleeping pills do not produce naturalistic sleep. And I'm not trying to shame anyone here. And if you have any questions, go and see your doctor. But those sleeping pills have also been related to a higher risk of death and cancer. People need not necessarily seek sleeping pills because there is a behavioral non-drug alternative called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI. And I encourage people to either look at the chapter in the book on that, or just go onto the internet and search that term, and they should be able to find help.
Thanks for that call, Kelly. Let's go next to Katie in Eau Claire. Hi, Katie.
Hi there. So I recently had a baby, and I tried this with my daughter, but we've done the ferberizing, or the cry it out method, and I've recently been reading a lot. Some people saying that it's good, some people saying that's bad, and I'm wondering what your guest take is on it.
All right. So, Matthew, for helping infants who are awake and crying, helping them get back to sleep so they can get that important sleep, what do you recommend?
Yeah, so the ferberizing method created by a professor by that name is that sort of let the child cry it out treatment, and gradually, almost like sort of letting the rope out on a sailboat, it gradually sort of go longer and longer with the duration of time before you go back in to try and comfort the child. That does seem to have some degree of benefits. There are some studies demonstrating that. But I would also say that you should just be attuned to your child. And if you really feel as though after going through that process systematically that it just doesn't seem to be working, then it's not a one-size-fits-all, and you can look to the alternatives. And I think experts are great in that regard. You can try it. It is a proven method, but it isn't for everyone. So just be a wonderful mother in that sense and be attuned to what your child needs.
All right. Thanks for that call, Katie. And Ruth in Eau Claire says she recommends sleeping masks. Made a world of difference for her, but you need to get the right one. And you were talking about how important darkness is, Matthew. Is there something we should look for in a sleeping mask?
Sleeping masks can be useful. Some people find them a little bit uncomfortable. An alternative is actually just buying blackout curtains. They can actually be just as effective. Some people who are especially sort of morning types, they tend to like the light coming through to the curtains, and so they prefer non-blackout curtains. But if you are someone who is particularly light sensitive, and many of us are, you can certainly try those blackout curtains. They can be very beneficial.
And as we start to wrap up, Matthew, is it possible to sleep too much, either in one night, or if you're sleeping at night and then napping during the day? Can we sleep too much? Is there such a thing as too much of a good thing?
Well, there is something called hypersomnia, but we principally see that in depression. But even if you look at that data, it seems to be people may be reporting staying in bed too long rather than sleeping too long. So at present, we don't actually have strong evidence for this thing called too much sleep. Is there such a thing? I think it's potentially possible. Some people describe a sleep hangover when they oversleep. That's usually because they are chronically sleep deprived, and they try to oversleep and sleep off that death.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for joining us. Matthew Walker is a professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Berkeley and the director of its Center for Human Sleep Science. His book is Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. This is Central Time.